from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, is recycling more about making us feel good than about good environmental stewardship? That's what the New York Times' John Tierney contends. 19 years after his article, Recycling is Garbage, came out, he's published another, The Reign of Recycling, and says not much has changed when it comes to the bottom line, both economically and environmentally. As California works to meet ambitious recycling and composting goals, is recycling a waste? We hash it out with experts next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to the second hour of Forum. I'm Mina Kim. For most of us, it's pretty routine. Separate the trash from the recycling and compost, and feel good that our plastic containers will likely become a park bench someday, or our food scraps will help make rich, fertile soil. In short, that we're doing our part to protect the environment. Not quite, says John Tierney of the New York Times. In his widely shared opinion piece this month, The Reign of Recycling, Tierney argues that recycling programs are inefficient and ineffective. Leading environmentalists disagree. They say the ecological benefits of recycling are clear. This debate comes as California works to meet an ambitious goal to recycle or compost 75% of its waste in the next 5 years. So let me tell you who is joining us to talk about this. It's Mark Murray. He's Executive Director of Californians Against Waste. Thanks for being here, Mark Murray.
It's good to be here.
We're also joined by Julian Morris, Vice President of Research at the Reason Foundation. Hello, Julian Morris.
Hi.
And Edward Humes is joining us as well. He's the author of Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. Good morning, Edward Humes.
Hey there, Mina.
I want to start with you, Julian Morris. You know, it's John Tierney's article that kind of relaunched this debate over the value of recycling. Could you just lay out some of the key points of his argument to get us started?
Well, I think to start with, John is not arguing that all recycling is bad, but rather that the push to recycle beyond the amount that would make economic sense can have adverse consequences, both economically and environmentally. He, for example, points out that when we try to recycle vast amounts of the vast proportion of plastic bottles, the net benefits in terms of energy saved is tiny. If one washes out the plastic bottles or other plastic containers before putting them in recycling, then there's a net cost because especially if you're using warm water, but even cold water, especially in places like California, where water in most places has to be pumped, you're using electricity, which uses resources. So essentially, he's saying that there are trade-offs.
But then, Julian, Morris, is if there's even a little net benefit, isn't that better than none? And then, if it's an issue of using water, then couldn't we just not wash them, not use water?
So it all depends on what people do. If you have cans that you're putting in your waste bin, you're putting cans in your recycling bin, and you don't wash them out beforehand, then they may well, if they've had fruit or something in them, they may well attract fruit flies and other things that you don't want. So they're people, when they practice recycling, they may do things that aren't accounted for when you're trying to design an optimal recycling scheme. At the same time, it's very difficult to predict in any individual case whether the recycling activity is going to have benefits or costs. So I live in a semi-rural area. We have a recycling program in our municipality that involves a separate truck going past our house and picking up various items for recycling. Many of those items that people put out are plastics. Some of them are things of have slightly higher value, like paper, and then much, much higher value, like tin cans, which would be either aluminum or made of steel. Those higher value items are worth recycling. The thing is that you can recycle them just as easily by separating them from the waste once you've got them to a waste management center and without having to have the separate pickup. So if you have the separate pickup, you're burning fossil fuels in having that pickup, and you're emitting things to the local environment here, as well as at the recovery center where they're taken to, which has a net cost in terms of the impact on the environment, and it impacts people locally.
Well, Mark Murray, since Julian Morris is bringing up plastics, for example, can we talk about the cost benefits, the costs and benefits related to this, and also, you know, the issue of the environmental impact of separate trucks and so forth?
Absolutely. So let me just deal with the truck issue first. We generate waste at our house, whether it goes in the recycling bin or whether it goes in the garbage truck. The exact same number of trucks and truck miles are needed, whether we're throwing it away or recycling it. It just means if we didn't recycle, there would just be twice as many miles on the garbage trucks than on the recycling trucks. Garbage trucks and recycling trucks both fill up before they go into their transfer station. So there is no difference in terms of the number of trucks. You may see the two trucks by your house, but that house, that truck is going to twice as many houses as it would if it was just a garbage truck or just a recycling truck. So there is no net difference in terms of truck miles. In terms of plastics, I mean, there is a point here. Not all plastics are recyclable. Not all plastics should be recycled. But as it ends up, there is a plastic bottle, the PET plastic bottle that our soft drinks and our waters are in. You know, those containers are very recyclable in California, 70% recycling rate. And there is, in fact, that container, when we put recycled content in it, is actually the most environmentally friendly container out there. So, for example, Nestle Waters this month announced 50% recycled content in their bottled water. That's a model that every beverage manufacturer should be following. That container is better for the environment than glass containers, than aluminum cans. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be recycling those other containers. It means that we need to be smart about which ones we do choose to recycle. There's a lot of plastic out there, like plastic bags, like polystyrene, that is not recyclable. And frankly, we should be phasing those out of the marketplace rather than trying to recycle them.
Edward Humes, do you want to jump in here on the value of plastics as part of our recycling regime?
Yeah, but I think we're really in the weeds here in details, and I'd like to look at the big picture.
Sure.
Of that John Tierney's ridiculous article, which is so rife with errors, it's an embarrassment to have been published in the New York Times. He tries to equate landfilling with recycling and says, well, it's always cheaper to throw our stuff into a big hole in the ground than it will be to recycle it. And he's correct, but that is a specious comparison. The real question is, what is the value of a recycled material versus a virgin material, a newly made one? And the answer generally favors recycled materials. If you look at recycling aluminum cans, it uses 96% less energy to do that than to refine it from bauxite ore. If you recycle glasses and jars and bottles, that saves 21% for glass versus making new glass. Recycling newsprint saves about 45% of the energy. And recycling plastic beverage bottle, that type of plastic, saves 76% of the energy. So there's tangible economic and environmental benefits for recycling many materials. Some materials have little value, most of it plastic, for recycling. As you just heard, grocery bags, foam clamshells, they can't break down in nature. They can't be recycled economically. And so what happens to them? They end up in the landfills. They end up in the ocean, where plastic pollution is a problem. And this is a serious waste issue. How do you get around that? Well, as we just heard, one suggestion is we stop using materials that end up in the environment and can't be usefully reused or recycled. And the reason they're so prevalent is because we have hidden subsidies that allow that kind of wasteful product to have a successful business model. And that subsidy consists of allowing makers of wasteful, harmful products to have no responsibility for cleaning them up or disposing of them properly. They're externalizing the cost of these products to taxpayers and consumers. Perfect example is junk mail. You know, one out of 100 pounds And in the average American landfill consists of junk mail, which is theoretically recycled, but rarely is. 1 out of 100 pounds, and who pays for that disposal of this unwanted and annoying product?
Julian Morris, so as Edward Humes is pointing out, I mean, is it really better to put these things in a landfill and to address that as a potential solution as opposed to really focusing on the production end of things?
Well, so first of all, I don't think that John Tierney is arguing that that landfill is always the better option. I will agree that there are merits in reforming the way that we manage our waste disposal. I am in favor of minimizing waste, but it rather depends on what one means by waste. If you conceptualize waste only as the thing that's going to landfill, then I wouldn't agree. I think what matters is the total cost to society. And if that's taken into account, then very often it does make sense to send waste to landfill. Landfills now, when they're engineered using modern techniques and complying with EPA regulations, are not generally polluting to groundwater. They can generate methane, but then it's possible to take that methane off and burn it. And there is no shortage of landfills. So it's important to get all of this into context. Meanwhile, recycling itself imposes an environmental burden very often. For example, if you're recycling newsprint, you have to go through a chemical process to lift the print off the paper before it goes through the process. That then has waste products that have to be disposed of. The problem here is that we're sort of narrowly defining waste as sort of a final waste product. So I would be in favor of reducing waste in the general sense of reducing the misuse of resources, but it's very, very difficult to take that into account when you have a system that whereby the decisions about how waste is managed are mostly taken by municipal governments that are biased towards these sort of arbitrary recycling targets. Now, some cities have put in place much more rational systems. For example, Seattle introduced a fee for the disposal of garbage. That encouraged people to reduce the amount of garbage that they produced, and to divert some more to recycling. Well, that, you know, if people have then the, if people can see the cost of waste that's going to the landfill, they can make the decisions themselves. But trying to set a sort of an arbitrary target centrally to dispose of waste through the recycling chain rather than through the landfill or the incineration energy recovery chain is I think a mistake.
So are you talking, Julian Fellows, then about California's targets? Do you think they're problematic in terms of trying to recycle or compost 75% of our waste by 2020? And in fact, halt all disposal of organic waste by 2025. That was recently announced by the California Air Resources Board.
Well, I would say yes. I mean, I think they don't make any economic sense, but they also don't make environmental sense.
Martin,
it's not driven by a rational an understanding of what the consequences are of moving towards a different set of systems for managing waste. And when those have been analyzed, and John Tierney refers to some of the analyses that have been done, including by the EPA, the conclusion is that pushing for 75% recycling or composting really doesn't make a lot of sense.
Mark Murray, I imagine you disagree.
Respectfully, that's absolutely wrong. California is leading the nation in recycling. We're at a 50% recycling rate right now. And we have the lowest disposal rates in the country in terms of our total waste management costs. We're showing that it makes economic sense to maximize waste reduction and recycling in California. We also are on the verge of moving forward with aggressive composting, taking that organic fraction, the green waste, the woody material, the food waste, out of the landfill. Right now, that material represents about 40% of the material that's left in our landfills. We know it makes economic sense and environmental sense to remove that material from landfill. We know that we're going to, you know, when we're burying all that organic fraction, we're burying water. So we can conserve water. It's ironic to hear Julian talk about EPA regulations, which his organization tends to oppose. But those EPA regulations on landfills don't keep landfills from emitting about 25 to 40% of the methane gas that is coming out of those landfills. So, and that methane is coming from that organic fraction. So we can reduce the cost of managing our landfills, we can reduce our reliance on landfills, and we can be adding a soil amendment back into our soils, food waste, organic waste, by hitting the ARB goal of eliminating this material from landfill.
But here's a trade-off.
Julian Morris.
So if you remove the organic matter from the general waste, you do indeed reduce the amount of methane that's produced. But as a consequence of that, you make it less economic to take that methane out and burn it and
it's not economic
it
right
to electricity.
Now. It's not economic right now. It is not.
There are some bioreactors in operation, for example, in Utah, that are economic. So it is possible to do it economically, but you have to start with the approach that you're trying to maximize the economic benefits of the system. And if you're
Julian,
taking out a lot of the waste that would otherwise generate that economic benefit, you're going to harm yourself.
Mark Murray, go ahead.
The gas that comes out of those landfills, the garbage gas that comes out of those landfills, it's extraordinarily dirty and it's extraordinarily inefficient. It's a good way to prevent that pollution from going into the environment, but it's not a great way for collecting gas. There are much more cost-effective ways, like anaerobic digestion. Segregate the organic fraction from the landfill and use an in-vessel anaerobic digester to capture 100% of that methane gas. And then you can utilize that gas. It's a cleaner gas. It's more cost effective. So the idea of mixing things up and then trying to separate them later, whether it's recyclables or it's organic fraction, is ridiculous. It doesn't make economic sense. It doesn't make environmental.
Let me bring in a comment from a listener. Rich writes, why wouldn't the garbage haulers just separate the valuable recycling from the garbage after they pick it up? They have a city-granted monopoly and a contract. They could be required to do so, and I believe they make a lot of money from that process. I'm not in the garbage business. They are. Other than the feel-good aspect, what is gained by all this time and effort expended by people paying the bill? Do you want to respond to that, Mark Murray?
You know, I was actually at a material recovery facility yesterday, and this is mixed recyclables pulling that material out. It is a process to sort that material, but it makes it much easier to sort that material when we separated the wet stuff from the dry stuff. The most sophisticated sorting machine in the world is not going to be able to recover 100% of the organic fraction and 100% of the recyclable fraction if you've mixed it all together first. So we do have an obligation as citizens to do a little bit of work on our part in terms of segregating our organic fraction, segregating our dry recyclables. And frankly, once you do that, there's not a lot left over.
It seems to me that John Tierney's article focuses a lot on the economics of recycling versus the environmental aspects of it so much. Edward Humes, do you want to weigh in on this?
I do, because that is exactly what it's about. You need both an environmental purpose behind your waste policies, but it has to make economic sense. You look at a company like Walmart. You know, they are a bottom-line company, and they don't do many things that don't serve that bottom line. They have been on a mission to reduce their waste, particularly their landfilling. They've cut it by 80% from their stores and their other lines of business as well. 80% less landfilling than they did in 2005, and they've ramped up their recycling. They've actually turned their waste into materials and revenue. It's black ink, not red ink for them. And you look at what some other countries have accomplished with their disposal policies. Austria, Germany, they landfill next to nothing. They either recycle it at 2 to 3 times the rate that America does, or they use it to make energy in small.
Edward Humes, are you still with us?
I am.
I think we just had your phone cut out slightly. Though right now we are in a situation where it seems China is, for example, is buying less of our recycled material. How does that change things globally? Edward
Hughes. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that question.
Oh, well, we are in a situation right now, right, where China is buying less of California's recycled materials. And so based on what you see as the way it works, you know, globally, all of our interconnections globally, what kind of effect could that potentially have? What kind of pressure could that potentially put on us here?
Well, there's still an enormous market. For, if you look at the sheer volume of containers going out of America's ports, our scrap and our trash is still our leading export, and it's very close to being our leading in, export in money. So there's huge value in this material, and we're letting other people reclaim it for us to make the products they sell back to us. So there has been some reduction in what China's taking, but there's other countries that are picking up some of that slack. In terms of globally, I think, you know, we have a lot to learn. We're really bad at recycling. We've had a 25-year effort to ramp up recycling, and it's not been a successful strategy overall because it has to be part of a bigger plan. You need to look at the kinds of materials that we're putting into our waste stream, and we have 50 billion coffee cups going into landfills every year because we haven't figured out an economical way to recycle a combo product that consists of paper and plastic. But again, we're allowing the producers of that and consumers of that material to sort of foist the cost of that product off on the country at large, to taxpayers.
Mark Murray, recycling does have its imperfections. I mean, in some ways, isn't it making us feel more virtuous than we should be feeling? I mean, I have to be honest, when I see corporate America promoting recycling, to some degree, I feel like they're making me feel better about purchasing things because I can feel assured that it will become something else.
Yeah, you know, I have to agree. I mean, in terms of the marketing, using recycling and the recycling label as a marketing label. Frankly, I'm with Ed in terms of we need to make the manufacturers of these materials, the producers and consumers of these materials, responsible for the end life. You know, there's an ad actually on or a sponsorship on your station where a car company is touting the fact that their gas-guzzling car is built in a zero landfill plant. Well, that's not really the problem with the car. So I think that there is a problem in terms of Madison Avenue has taken over this term recyclable. And I think that, you know, in terms of some of the examples that John Tierney raised in terms of costs of recycling, the cost of recycling is increased when people are doing wishful recycling, when they're putting materials that aren't really recyclable, like a plastic bag, like a polystyrene fast food package. I saw lots of those at the material recovery facility yesterday.
We're talking about a recently widely shared New York Times article that questions the effectiveness of recycling both for the economy and the environment. What are your thoughts? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. You can also reach us on Facebook or Twitter. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about a recent New York Times article that questions the effectiveness of recycling, both for the economy and the environment. And we're joined by Mark Murray, Executive Director of Californians Against Waste, Edward Humes, author of Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash, and Julian Morris, Vice President of Research at the Reason Foundation. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Julian Morris, before the break, we were talking about one point that I think Tierney makes that it sounds like we can all kind of agree on, which is that recycling has been relentlessly promoted as a goal in and of itself, and that that needs to be questioned.
Exactly. I mean, I think that this is the problem, that instead of allowing the amount of recycling that makes sense to emerge as a result of a kind of discovery process between consumers, or if you are like disposers, and the companies that would pick up and either recycle or burn or dispose of garbage through in landfills. Rather than allowing that discovery process to take place, there's been this presumption that recycling is a good thing, and that we need to design products, for example. And we've heard that both Edward and Mark suggest that products that are on the market need to be designed in order to make them more recyclable. Well, that sounds like a great idea, but there are some problems. So, for example, it turns out that if you package oranges in the form of orange juice and distribute them through the use of what are called laminated packs of them. These are packages that are made from a mixture of aluminum, plastic and paper. You can actually save enormously on resources because you're moving around, instead of moving around tons of orange carcass, the peel and rind on an orange, you're only moving around the juicy bits and that people want to consume, you can save on all sorts of waste. I mean, a huge proportion of fruit wastes before it arrives at the consumer. So if you can deliver that fruit to the consumer in a way that enables them to use it without wastage, you're saving there. At the same time, you can use the when oranges are processed immediately from after being picked in Florida or wherever in California, you can use the peel and rind for different processes. You can take out the limonene and that goes into industrial processes or food. You can take out the you can actually grind the rind up and feed that to animals. So you can use the basic resources much more effectively if you're processing them and distributing them in materials that keep them fresh for a long period. If you eliminated laminated packs, as has been suggested by Edward was suggesting that they were not such a great idea. Then you make that not possible.
So you're saying that better packaging reduces costs by reducing things from spoiling and breaking?
It reduces spoilage and it increases the efficiency of use of resources. In other words, it reduces waste. It reduces the amount of biological matter of putrescible materials that would otherwise be breaking down and producing methane, however that is then collected or not.
But why wouldn't you just use better packaging that had some recyclable material in it?
Well, these aseptic packs were originally developed by the folks at Tetra Pak about 50 years ago are just incredibly good at keeping goods fresh without needing refrigeration. So you can use other packaging materials. You can use plastic by itself, but those typically require refrigeration, which has a high energy cost. So if you want the least energy reliant materials, then you're going to have to allow innovators to develop and manufacture these things and work out how to dispose of them later.
Mark Murray, is California trying to figure out ways to deal with things like Tetra Paks or multi-layered packaging?
Well, honestly, it's really not the responsibility of the government to figure that out. It's the responsibility of the packaging manufacturer. And I think that that's where Ed and I are kind of disagreeing with Julian, in that we think that the producers need to have that responsibility when they're designing the product in the first place. And it's not to say that they shouldn't be looking at innovative designs that reduce the need for refrigeration, but they need to simultaneously be looking at opportunities to recycle and to make that material compatible with our recycling systems. And the fact is that the Tetra Pak, those boxes could be recycled, but it's going to take an investment by the manufacturers. They're going to have to buy the material from the material recovery facility.
And have you been in conversation with producers about that, and what kind of response are you getting, Mark?
We have those. Murray. California has attempted to have those conversations.
Right.
And there's been multiple pieces of legislation. The manufacturers band together to oppose producer responsibility legislation. We've had a couple examples of success in California, our bottle and can recycling law. You know, we are, when manufacturers aren't stepping up and demonstrating that they can cost-effectively manage the end of life of their product, like plastic bags, California has said we're ready to phase them from the marketplace.
Well, we have a lot of listeners who would like to weigh in here. Let's go to Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Good morning. I was wondering, I know a while back, probably a couple of decades ago, in particular the printer cartridges, they have a buyback system, basically, where you can return. A system was developed where you can return those in order to have them refilled. HP was very big in this. They had a couple of plants that did it. Why can't that be, that kind of route be taken with regard to, obviously not drink packs and things like that, but some of the more intensive things that show up in the landfill? I've been operating landfills for 25 years, and I still watch thousands of tons of recyclables go in them every day. So I'll take my answer off the air.
What about this end-use responsibility, Julian Morris?
So the idea I think the end user should be responsible. I'm against the producer being responsible, but right now the end user is faced with only a sort of more or less a binary choice. They can either dispose of their garbage in the general garbage if the municipality operates it, a recycling scheme. So I think that it would be good to open that up. There are municipalities around the country that actually have private contracting for garbage disposal, and people then can make the choice. They can pay for the general waste disposal only. They can pay for some mixture of general waste or recycling if it's offered. So that idea, I think, is a much better one than producer responsibility. Europe has experimented with producer responsibility, and I can tell you that it causes an incredible increase in costs. So when Germany introduced the duale system Deutschland, the double system, basically, which was paid for by the packagers and was a response to the requirement that packagers pick up, I think initially between 50% and 75% of their material, and it gradually increased over time. The cost of disposing of waste in Germany doubled, and it imposed additional costs on the environment because you did really have additional separate waste streams going to packaging. And packagers switched from the more efficient forms of packaging, including plastic PET bottles, which we've heard about as being a good way of moving drinks around. They switched to glass bottles because glass is more easily recovered. And that drove up costs because the glass bottles are heavier and the resources that you can extract from them, relatively speaking, cost wise are lower. I mean, it really was nutty.
Do you want to comment on Julian Morris's point about driving up costs as a result of trying to put the responsibility on the producer?
Well, what we're trying to do, the goal ought to be, is to provide incentives to develop the sorts of products that are less wasteful. Sometimes market forces do that on their own, but in some cases we have these perniciously wasteful products, like a plastic grocery bag that has a useful life you measure in minutes and a waste life that lasts for centuries, and we're turning these kinds of products loose on the environment, not just in landfills where many end up, but in our oceans. And there's many reasons to try and provide incentives for eliminating these products from the waste stream as much as we can. And sometimes you do that as the 10 states that have container deposit laws have done. Those states all out-recycle all the other states in the union by far, and it's been very successful. And that sort of in that case, consumer responsibility incentive has worked very well and has created a market for those types of recyclables. And those are the kinds of solutions that are proven and that can alter the nature of what we landfill and what we recycle and the sorts of containers that are produced. And I'm not as familiar as Julian is with the experiences Germany has had, but I can tell you that they have 2 to 3 times the recycling rate that the U.S. does. that they have about 1% of their trash goes to landfills, and they have a very robust use of waste-to-energy plants to use some of the materials that can't otherwise be recycled into reusable materials.
Well, let's get a
they have a formula that is way better than ours.
Well, let's get a call in from Jeremy in San Leandro who wants to talk about what it's like in Canada. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, go ahead.
Sure. So this is specifically about the consumer side of the amount of waste that's used, especially in the household. I moved here from Canada. I was living in Ontario for a bit, and then I now live in the East Bay. And my household habit, when required to separate trash from plastics to glass and make all of the separations, gave me visibility to how much I was consuming. And coming here, there's less of that. And that put less visibility on how much I'm consuming, which inherently makes me not cautious about my consumption. Mm. So the force of separation does two things. One, it brings awareness, which inherently will bring down the amount consumed because of putting it up front and right to the consumer and having their choices be directly visible to them on a daily basis. So all the other things are very as far as separation and cost and methane and all those other discussions are all very good and should be had. But reducing the actual consumer's use pattern by allowing them to feel their own choices likely will have probably the lowest, the biggest payback as far as how much reduced consumption there are of all of those categories.
And Jeremy, thank you, Jeremy. Jeremy is bringing up the good point about also, you know, we learned three great options in terms of how to deal with our trash, right? Reducing it, reusing our products, or recycling it. And most people really do that third one, right, Mark Murray? But it's been described as the worst best solution.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, the point that I'm hearing Jeremy make, and I would point out that Ontario actually has a producer responsibility system very similar to the German system. It's very successful in terms of having the manufacturers responsible for the cost of the materials that they're recycling. But I think Jeremy's point is that it's communicating to the consumer. I've got my recycling bin, I've got my composting bin, and then I've got what's left over. And that should be a high cost to put it into that what's left over bin, that garbage bin. And maybe that's where Julie and I would agree, is that there should be a high cost of disposal so that folks recognize that if it doesn't go in the recycling bin and it doesn't go in the composting bin and I'm going to have to pay that environmental cost of putting it in the garbage bin, maybe I shouldn't get that in the first place. Maybe I should be looking for alternatives that don't have that high disposal cost that I've got to throw it away.
Listener writes, even if recycling isn't perfected, there's a benefit to getting people into the habit so that when technology advances, the behavior will be ingrained. George writes, we recycle to make our landfills last longer. It's called diversion. Stuff we recycle doesn't go into our landfills. When our landfills fill up, we'll pay dearly to haul our rubbish hundreds of miles to someone else's backyard for disposal. And Samantha writes, even if it is small, there has to be benefit to recycling in that the plastic doesn't make it into the ocean. So we're getting a lot of support here for the value of recycling. And this question of technology, so Mark Murray, we have set very ambitious or goals, right? I mean, we're at, what, 50% in terms of our statewide recycling or composting of waste?
50%, yeah, 50% in California. And I want to point out, you know, San Francisco has set even higher goals than that and is right now hitting an 80% recycling goal in San Francisco. So, you know, now maybe that's a function of having smaller yards than some of the rest of us, but, you know, San Francisco is leading the way and the folks at the Department of the Environment.
But where are we at in terms of infrastructure to deal with all of this waste?
Well, I think kind of back to your question a while back, we've done a great job of setting up a collection infrastructure and a processing infrastructure for your basic recyclables. We're now needing to build an infrastructure for the collection, processing, and composting of that organic fraction.
Right.
But there's another piece of this, and that is we need to be utilizing this material here in California. We need to be taking the material, and not just, you know, as Ed was kind of describing, we've become a banana republic in terms of shipping our value-added recyclables overseas. We ship 20 million tons of material overseas, and it actually has a value of $8 billion. We need to be utilizing that material here, and policymakers in California have been focused on that issue. The governor just signed legislation that provides a tax credit for entities that build processing and manufacturing in California for recycling and composting. So policymakers get it. We understand that we have to close the loop here in California and utilize this material, and that's kind of the next big thing in terms of building, manufacturing, using recycled materials right here in California.
So then,
Nina,
what?
We have a ways to go to accomplish that too.
Edward Humes.
We're still putting more of our recyclables in landfills than, and I'm talking about the high value stuff like aluminum cans, for instance. Almost 50% of those are still going into landfills. You know, the can makers value this material so much that the typical America soda can or beer can has about 70% recycled content in it, recycled aluminum. But we don't, our consumers are recycling enough of it, or our municipal waste agencies. And so we actually have to import old aluminum cans or, you know, the aluminum that comes from it from other countries in order to get the recycled content of American cans high enough to meet the manufacturer's needs. Now, that's just crazy.
Right. Certainly cutting out the middleman would definitely make a lot of sense. But are there barriers to getting manufacturers to realize the opportunity in recycled materials in California?
Can I just say, I think we're really not going far enough. I mean, if we're going to start recycling everything in California, we should go further. We should be recycling everything in San Francisco. Better than that, let's recycle everything that's produced in the mission. And not only that, let's actually produce everything from scratch in the mission. Oh, that's not going to work. Why is it not going to work? It's not going to work because not everything that people want to consume in the mission is available for access in the mission. You're not going to have enough basic agricultural goods produced. You're not going to have your Apple iPods produced there, et cetera, et cetera.
But isn't an interim solution okay, Julian Morris? I mean, something in the middle? Mark Murray?
You know, I think that obviously Julian's being facetious, but I will tell you that, you know, if you're in California, if you live in California and you have the benefit of having a backyard, grass and trees in around your home, then I do think that you have a responsibility to come up with a system at your house for making sure that the trimmings and your grass clippings, you're composting those at home. I don't think that you should be imposing that organic
fraction. Well, what if they can be used more?
Julian Morris, let Mark Murray finish, please.
I'm not suggesting that we should go back to a homespun economy in California, but I do think that consumers have a responsibility to purchase materials that are compatible with our recycling and composting system, to recycle those materials that are recyclable. I think that manufacturers have responsibility not just for giving us the products that we want, but for designing those products for sustainability, source reducing those products, not giving us excess packaging, designing them for recycling, designing them so that they're compatible with a food waste composting program. It's ridiculous that food to go is being served in packaging that isn't itself compostable. If I'm getting a sandwich or a salad, you know, or a beverage in a to-go cup at a fast food establishment, at a county fair, or at an outdoor event, all that packaging should be compostable, so all of it can go into the food waste composting bin.
Julian Morris.
Well, I just don't understand why anyone believes that the manufacturer of a good knows how that good is going to be disposed of. Now, I can see that at a food stall in a county fair, that the operator of that food stall can see what the consumer is doing with the food immediately in front of them. But they don't know where it's taken. They don't know exactly what's going to happen to it. Maybe it's actually going to be stored in a fridge overnight, in which case maybe it's a good thing that the container will last overnight, so it's made of styrofoam. On the other hand, you know, maybe it's going to be immediately disposed of in a garbage can that isn't for recyclable waste, in which case maybe it's better that it's a very, very lightweight container that doesn't take up much space and level. I think this is the problem here is that you're trying to design a system from the top down without understanding what consumers do on the ground with their products. And the fact that those consumers are very, very diverse, there are over 300 million people in America, and they have diverse needs and diverse wants and diverse ways of dealing with their trash. Thinking that you can design a system from the top down, I think, is crazy. It makes a lot more sense to encourage from bottom up systems to emerge that use resources more efficiently. And generally, the free market is pretty good at that, but there are things the things about waste management in the United States that are not free market.
I really need to let our listeners get in here a little bit. Deborah Nicasio, go ahead, Deborah.
Hi. I think many of my points have been made, so I'll try and be brief. Thank you for listening to me. I think that Jeremy has said a lot of really helpful stuff, and I think for me and the people I know, unless you're penalized, unless you have to pay, and that goes all the way up to the corporate level, I think laws need to be passed to make people pay if they don't do it right. And my mother is a darling example, bless her heart. She's a bit of a penny pincher, and I asked her about her recycling one day, and she said, "I have it all figured out, honey. That's the wet, and that's the dry." I guarantee you she'd learn how to do it if you charged her $10 a month on her trash bill. Guaranteed. So that's just my two cents.
Thanks for sharing that comment, Deborah. Let's go to Marge in Sherman Island. Hi, Marge.
Well, hi. I wanted to talk about some of this packaging. When you buy something from the store, like I bought a drill, a small electric drill from the store, battery operated, the package was twice the size of the drill, and it was plastic, a hard plastic with cardboard liner. I never did get into the whole package. It took me 20 minutes to find something that would cut through the plastic to get the drill out of there. I couldn't get the instructions out. It was just awful. And sometimes you buy things from the dollar store that are also in this kind of hard plastic, clear plastic covering with cardboard that's inserted in there, and you can't get the thing apart.
Wondering whether that's recyclable?
I know it's not recyclable. And then
Mark Murray,
the thing is, she's
absolutely right. It's not recyclable. And again, I want to introduce the free market into that equation. I want that manufacturer to be responsible for the very real free market costs of managing that waste for disposal. And so it's got a cost. It also has an impact on consumers. I mean, I know how frustrating that PVC blister pack packaging can be when you're trying to get at a tool or a toy or something like that. They're overpackaged. The packaging is not recyclable. And the manufacturer is not economically responsible for those costs.
David in Oakland. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Go ahead.
Okay, so very quickly, I work in recycling and have worked for a number of years with an Oakland-based recycling center called Alliance Recycling. And there hasn't been much discussion of the role of recycling centers in the private market in the process here. Currently, the city of Oakland is actually trying to close down Alliance Recycling because of gentrification in the neighborhood and a desire to build housing in its place. But the reality of it is, the recycling centers are a huge and important hub in the process, and yet they're under a lot of pressure. So, for example, 2 years ago, the state of California changed its rules on what you can take to a recycling center and eliminated payments for a large number of items. And, in fact, those are going into landfill. And yet there are a lot of people. There's kind of a gray market and a small army of people who go around and pick these up and bring them to recycling centers. So the question is, what's the reaction toward this sort of antagonism towards recycling centers and the view of the commentators?
Mark Murray, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, you know, that's a big battle in the Bay Area, certainly in San Francisco, where there has been shutting down of recycling centers. And the buybacks, the drop-off recycling centers, play a tremendous role in terms of introducing people to recycling, giving them that one-on-one kind of exchange, and they're extraordinarily cost-effective. So we need to build on that model rather than getting rid of that model. I mean, I love the convenience of my curbside recycling program, but I also know that not 100% of the glass that I put into my curbside recycling bin is going to get recycled because the system ends up breaking and destroying that. You're better off taking your glass to a buyback recycling center where it is going to get recycled more cost effectively, and you know that 100% of that glass is going to get recycled, and we know that glass bottles made from recycled content are better for the environment than glass bottles that are not made with recycled content. So if you want to drink your beer in glass, then you better be recycling your beer bottles, and you'd be better off recycling your beer bottles at a buyback recycling center rather than curbside.
And let's try to get one last call in. Kevin from the San Francisco Department of the Environment.
Hi there. I just wanted to congratulate you on a great show, and a lot of the things that have been said I want to go over, but there's some emerging science that kind of feeds into this, the notion of local solutions. We've been focused on organics here in San Francisco, and the state has moved in a big way to capture the organic stream and turn it into compost and energy. That compost has just been found through science at UC Berkeley and Lawrence Berkeley Lab to have a tremendous impact on climate by sequestering carbon on the soils nearby where we capture that that organic matter.
Well, thanks for your point about composting. And I also want to thank Mark Murray, Executive Director of California's Against Waste, for joining us, Julian Morris, Vice President of Research at the Reason Foundation, and Edward Humes, author of Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, and Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement editor is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from David Marks. Our interns are Latoya Tools and Jeremy Siegel, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.